Can you please explain more about getting plugged into negativity, which I mentioned this morning after the meditation with instructions? I found it easier than getting plugged into positivity. Is it easier for the mind? Thanks. It's interesting to feel into how when we get plugged into negativity, it can start to accelerate and get intense. And also, when we feel, as I said yesterday, that openness that allows kindness and steadiness to come, or allows our natural human qualities to come through, that also has a way that it feeds itself and is very sustainable. So it can be hard to tell the difference if we look at it with the thinking mind. Negativity is building. It seems to have more and more and more and more and more energy, taking all of our energy. And at a certain point, there will be some kind of end. We'll either get bored with it, or something will break, for example. That's when we're plugged in, and there's like a closed system. In fact, there's not enough room for all of our energy. And there are different, let's also mention a few things that can help when we get plugged into negativity. Just recently, I was remembering a time, luckily for me, long ago. From childhood on, for reasons that I do know, I had a fear of the dark. And at one point I was an adult and I was visiting my mother for a while between trips to India, as some of you might know how that goes. Getting some money, getting some visa and going back home to India. And somehow I got plugged into this fear of the dark, and it got worse and worse. It was getting so intense. And there was that, how can this be? I live in India, I do meditation, etc. Which doesn't help. And I was trying all of my tools and all my tricks and all my resources, and it wasn't helping. Then I felt more foolish, ridiculous, and ashamed, and that wasn't helping either. It was more and more plugging in. Every single plug that I had was plugged in to this ridiculous fear. Then, luckily, good old life came along, and there was a chance out of nowhere to go to someone, I don't even know whose house it was, at the beach somewhere. I don't remember where it was, for a few days. Then it was over. I just got out of that house, which is a fine house. I didn't have problems with my mother in that way. It wasn't like that. It was just something got stuck, and then it got more stuck. And I hated being stuck, and so it got more stuck. And then there was just a chance to get out of that, all of those triggers, and it was okay. It didn't hurt that it was a nice house by the beach with a nice breeze and etc. Sometimes to unplug, we actually need to, like, take the whole body and unplug it, put it somewhere else for a while. And we can think, oh, but I don't have a beach house by the, well, I don't either. But life does. Life has a lot of, there's a teacher in India that some of you might have heard of. Doesn't matter if you haven't. Nisargadatta Maharaj. And he's no longer living. He used to hang out, usually dressed in a blanket. That was his wardrobe, was a blanket, a plaid wool blanket. And he had a lot of friends, but he wasn't one of those gurus with, like, all the cars and that kind of thing. And one time he said, someone was worried about going back to the United States and didn't have money, and And his name, they called him Maharaji, Great King Maharaji, in a blanket. He said, don't worry, I own all the money in the United States of America. And then the student of this teacher, knowing it was partly a joke and kind of not also, it's not that this man actually owned all the money, but something else is going on other than, luckily, just the banking system and the economics as we know it. And then having that lightness, being the student and being told by your teacher, don't worry, I own all the money in the United States of America. It was fine. And even went to the bank and something, like someone handed him money or something crazy like that. So, unplugging happens when there's a kind of lightness, a lightening up. And so it's partly our job to notice what happens to help us lighten up. Carefully also, the other side, and this starts to get more sticky, noticing what plugs you in to negativity. Eventually we talk about what plugs you into anything, what plugs you in whatsoever. But the most urgent question is what plugs us into negativity. But not making that our whole occupation. Our love of the negativity, of being in it and having it all over us, though we hate it, as a way of being occupied, as a way of not living, would love that meditation is all about finding out what plugs me into the negativity. Then we can really be busy. We can really know what's happening and why and how. So unplugging is noticing and accepting how much of the time, no matter where we are, what kind of meditation, or whether we're driving, or whether we're riding in a bus, or whatever we're doing. We might seem to be occupied, we might seem to be occupied with doing nothing. Unoccupied. Our energy does like to plug in to something and be busy with it. So the question is it easier for the mind to plug into negativity? Yes. So first feeling in your own experience, is it easier for your mind to plug into negativity or positivity? For some people, it's both are okay. Both are possible. Both can get into a flow. But for most of us, somewhere in the background, even if we have closer to the front, a kind of happy person, happy presentation, happy mood more often. Usually in the background, there is an ongoing readiness for negativity of some kind. So when we say negativity, maybe the first thing that comes to my mind is more like active negativity, like anger, something that you can feel the destructiveness of it. And we think of the more self-destructive energies like anxiety and insecurity as being less negative. We might think that way. But if we feel what the experience is, it's negative. It's destructive. It's eating away at us. So we plug into and we give our life to. Okay, then we have to address the image of plugging into. Of course, we don't usually deliberately go and stick our finger in the socket, which is basically what it is. There's a really good image from one of my favorite books in India, Sanskrit text called Yoga Vashisht, of what I'm talking about and what this person's asking about. The plugging into negativity, what is that, and why is it so easy to do? There's something in us that's happy to be like a dog with a bone and the bone has nothing. The bone is so dry and so without any life and without any nourishment that it's also dry and sharp, and it cuts the mouth of the dog, and so there's the taste of blood, which is the blood of the dog in the mouth of the dog. It's a really horrible, true metaphor for what's happening and why it doesn't feel so right. It doesn't feel so good. We can also pay attention to what is the personality style that you happen to be in. And in Buddhist psychology, they talk, for example, about people who are more negativity oriented. So they're more aversive, they're more angry, they're more aggressive in their presentation. Don't think that if you're not that kind, you don't have that aggression there. In their approach, in their way of first relating. So you arrive at the retreat, if you're the aversive type, and you see all that's wrong, for example. And you might even want to get away. You might even leave, or you might just stay, keep your distance, or whatever. When there's more of, let's not call it positivity, but more pleasure seeking or orientation around pleasure, then someone might arrive here and see how great, oh, it's so great, and all these nice people and all this great silence. And they might see what's great, and they might also, another version of it is, when we're in the pleasure seeking, there might be something in us, put it more clearly, there's something in a radar in the person that's looking for where I might get more benefit. And so then they go and, what is that, like networking or whatever. You go and work, before we go into silence, you go and meet so-and-so and make a good impression on people and get connected. That's one version. What can be difficult about the pleasure seeking, because it doesn't sound so bad to see how great it is that it's an ignoring of what might need attention now while you're still able to speak, for example. You might need to talk to your roommate about something before you go into silence, and it's not so great, whatever. So it's the blindness that's the problem. That's what we're interested in. And then there's the style that we could call just pure ignoring, so that someone comes and doesn't notice anything. And they don't really care where they sit in the hall. So there could be someone who, knows where they want to sit, and they get there early and they get their seat. And that could come from aversion or from pleasure seeking. But this more ignoring type would just like, what? We're supposed to have a place in the hall? That all three styles are styles of ignoring, and all three styles are styles of aversion. All three styles are styles of pleasure seeking. Getting away from what I don't like is a movement towards what I like, which might be space. Can just invert. But not to be confused, not to think that just because you notice a lot of complaining in the top of your mind or the front of your personality, not to think that you necessarily have a much greater problem with negativity than someone who has a lot of happiness and positivity in the front of their mind, in the front of their personality, yeah? Or that someone who's kind of like, oh, yeah, whatever. It's not necessarily equanimity. It's not necessarily deep okayness. It's not tuned into. It's another kind of ignoring. Okay. In the background of all of the personality styles, of any personality, there is usually a plugging in to what we could call negativity or destructiveness. If we would like to, we could look at it in a psychological way. I wouldn't like to limit it to that, but it could be helpful to have that as one layer of our understanding and exploration. If, let's put it this way instead of making it as a statement, if, or what if as children, there were the times that we didn't get what was needed, which happens. If, as children, there wasn't permission to be fully human. If, as children, there was some way that we were, not verbally usually, but in some way our being was asking to be met as a full human being. And most often we're not. And then there starts to come an agreement in the being, in us deeply, that we can't be met, that somehow we're alone or something is not quite right. So that would be the psychological version. And then we start from that place of not quite right, of feeling separate, feeling isolated, feeling not met, feeling not, oh, I'm not really full. What was that fully human thing again? We lose track of it. We somewhere agree to lose track of the fully human experience. And we get busy. So from the place of separation. So that, in a way, we can say like unplugging from or disconnected, uprooted from an experience of energy coming from nowhere and moving through in a way that's human. So that's called love, and it's called steadiness, and it's called kindness. It's called strength. We come to an agreement that we are a thing that has to come up with love and kindness and steadiness. And we can't always come up with it. And so then we have to start hiding even more. And so there's that example that Michalji gave this morning, or was it yesterday, of being busy with, and then I expect that by being busy with, I'm going to earn the right to rest. So if we notice that means we've agreed that we don't already have the right to rest from the beginning. So that's what we've agreed to unbuckle from, or all the usual words are not going to be quite right. There is a kind of knowing in the way that Michalji said this morning, like we're sure, and somewhere maybe we know that's not true, all that sureness. So maybe sense that all of this comes up by itself. All of this is happening by itself. The body is going on. The mind is going on. The world is going on. It's coming up by itself. It is given. Out of nowhere. And if there's any meaning to it, it doesn't fit into our meanings that we would give. if there's a purpose or purposes, it has nothing to do with what we think of by that word. So, I don't know, can you feel how that background agreement that I'll ignore the experience of being fully human, that's aggression? Can you feel what I'm saying? That agreement to start from not good enough, got to improve it first, then I'll rest, then I'll be. That's aggression. If you have any question, please ask. Try more, if possible, to feel it. We're allowed to notice that is aggression. That is normal. That's the norm. And that is aggression. It's hatred. It's rejection of what's important. It's ignoring life. And of course, from there, then we start to think that we should be in control, and this is, it's a mess, according to our freaked out thinking. So, being plugged into the negative is that, into the negativity. Because from that, from that agreement to ignore that a human being is bottomless, is immeasurable, and limited. The agreement to ignore the immeasurable part, the mystery part, the agreement to ignore the mystery of our being, is a foundation of aggression. It's like, we're setting the table with aggression. So then, of course, what we're most likely to serve on that table is aggression, is negativity. That makes sense. And that doesn't make sense, but it makes sense when we look at that table and we get that, okay, we get into that. We get on a roll. Then when we eat that food, it makes sense that we would talk that talk, etc. So, is there any question now? Yes. Yes. We'll get there. Thank you. So the question is that here I'm talking about strong negativity. I want to just add pause into the question. I'm not only talking about strong negativity. I'm talking about also a subtle background negativity that's on almost all the time. It doesn't cover up everything, but it's almost always on. Okay. So it's not only, I'm not only talking about when I'm completely lost in rage and hatred and self-defeat and all that. Okay. So, but the interest is in, okay, what about kindness and how to have more kindness in my life? And I said, yes, definitely we go there. To go there, I want to really understand this. Otherwise, we'll try to be kind from a place of aggression and it won't be kind. It'll look kind. And it can even look really, really kind. So, because what I'm saying now is really... the core thing that people don't talk about. It's not the end of the story. It's not all there is. Okay, so if you have a question, if it comes, yes. How do you live in peace with this How to live in peace with that, being limited and being limitless. Yeah. Okay. We'll go there also. But we could say for now, the how to have more kindness, how to, that Rumi asks us to be howless. Go to the well, howlessly. So we have the chance again and again, and it's not to say that you are doing that now, but usually when I ask, okay, but how? I hear, whoa, that's impossible to be limited and limitless. And I know what you mean, and it's true, and it's impossible, and I don't know how. And then here we are again, assuming what the assumption is, because I don't know how, I can't. And what we're now starting to uncover is the possibility that because I don't know how, I can. Because I know I don't know how, I can. Because it is impossible. So it's great how your question goes right onto the, okay, more kindness. Exactly. Get off of the negativity. And yeah. So there's a reason for that. She's saying, I know I want to get to the kindness because I'm so familiar with the negative thing and I'm not familiar with the kindness thing. And now, yeah, sorry. Of course. Thank you. Less familiar. Not familiar with the kindness thing. So now we can go to that. There's a reason for that. There's a reason we are more familiar with the negativity thing, the negative thing, and less familiar with the kindness thing. Because the kindness is not a thing. And that's why I want to get really clear on this first part. When the part of us that wants to make kindness into a thing, that I can have my thing that helps me get connected to more kind to that thing, I'll do my thing to get more of that thing. I'm in the aggression again. I'm in the basic agreement to ignore all of this unlimited. So kindness isn't a thing. It happens exactly when there's space. So we often think of the heart as a thing, and we want to open it, and we want to soften it, and we want to make it bigger, and we want to make it stronger. What else do you want to make it be? I'm trying to remember all the sweeter, warm, big. Anything else? What is loving, though? What is loving? Who said that? I couldn't. Okay. She said to me, and she, her hands are like this. It's the outpouring. Loving is the outpouring of the self, she said. So it's, to me, it's a, there's a flow and there's a, the hands went like that. There's openness. Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You smile like a what?
Like a fool.
Like a fool. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Definitely. Good. Yes. Could everyone hear? Oh, wow. I'm glad I could. Okay. So, I'm trying to remember your name. Asya? Asya is saying she immigrated from Russia, where to be happy is shameful. You're smiling like a fool, they say. And what she's noticing here, by contrast, is Here, you're suffering like a fool. So there's this extra burden of shame upon the suffering. Not only are you in pain, you shouldn't be in pain. You're suffering like a fool. And so, yeah, the shame or the resistance in any way. So even when there's cultural pressure not to suffer, that you should get yourself together and get over it and come on. Like Asya was saying, there's this idea that we should be self-confident and that would be enough to get over it. Which it can help sometimes, some confidence, but. When we're told that we should, it doesn't go well. Whether there's the voice inside or outside telling us. There's also, a more basic and or subtle resistance to feel what's negative or painful. So when we have the shame, cultural shame, and then personal shame, and then this really basic resistance to feel what it is, then we're really stuck. And so for me, at that time at my mom's house, when I was every time more afraid of the dark, in my 20s, I wasn't a child anymore. It was certainly the resistance and suffering like a fool kind of treatment of myself that let it be stronger, forced it to be stronger. So that does give us one small trick, and that is that we can feel that it's just painful. That the anger at myself, aside from any story about how I shouldn't be angry at myself or why I'm angry about myself or whatever, we could notice that there's resistance to the anger. We could just feel it. And when we're in direct contact with it, actually, it's never as bad as we thought it would be. So it's, again, when I relate to my idea of the anger or the fear or whatever. So there are times that we need outside help with some of the really intense situations. We might need medication. We might need therapy. We might need a hug, massage, exorcism, whatever. So I don't want to not say that. Okay. The negative feelings and the feelings of negativity and the feelings of the destructive force that happens in our psyche are relatively easy to feel. And we are very practiced at feeling them. And our whole system is really ready to go on to the alarm emergency mode at the smallest suggestion that there could be something wrong. The smallest little taste of that original or initial agreement to disconnect. So that's why we need to practice something else. We need to leave room for everything. And notice how it's my resistance to feeling the negative, actually. Though we think, and we are in it all the time, we're not actually feeling it. That's why we're in it all the time. When I actually feel it, it's simple, and it falls apart. But be careful, because the mind's going to trick us and pretend that I'm really feeling it, and it's just indulging its addiction to negativity. And partly, we're addicted to it because it's easy. It's easy to feel. It gives us a confirmation that I exist and I'm here and there's a ground even though it sucks. Okay. And the kindness and the even happiness can be harder to feel. It's less, solid. So it's from the very beginning, we can say generally it's a more subtle feeling. So there are things like where there's excitement mixed in, which is actually coming from that original disconnection. Because I'm so excited because I'm about to get enlightened and then I can finally be myself. It's still that bad agreement that happened. And it's good to sort it out means to let it untangle itself. Excitement from another kind of lightening up. So that's why I'm lightening it up. So the practice, the journey, what happens along the way is like it's unpacking and throwing away. And then there's a little more space. Unpacking. Unpacking. This is not mine. 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 And then we get, you know, tired of all of that. It hurts our wrists. Get somebody else to do it for us. It starts to happen more automatically. There's a noticing immediately. This is not mine. Throwing it away, throwing it away. There's more and more and more space. It's, though, it sounds great, but it's very disorienting. Because all the way till now, the best we could do was here's me doing my best, trying to find kindness, trying to heal the hurt and trying to be less mean and to myself and others and tune into some kind of harmony that's bigger than me. But there was this reference point in here, me meditating, me talking to God, me whatever I'm doing, me feeling peace, me able to feel, whoa, me able to notice that's an idea. And as we unpack more and more, as the unpacking goes on, sometimes then we notice there's not a me anymore. There's not a reference point anymore. And it can feel like some people talk about like a black hole. They feel completely lost. They don't know how to meditate anymore because how they meditated was me meditating. Now who's going to meditate? Does it make sense to me? And we can't figure it out because it doesn't match all of our past experience. So this is when limitless starts to be allowed back in. So we want to be disoriented. We even could say confusion is really great. One of my teachers says confusion is a really good sign. Not every kind of confusion, but it often is because it's a disorienting. My new experience is actually allowed to change the map or to say, let's go without a map. There's a poem by Wendell Berry, and a U.S. poet who's still living. He lives in the countryside and writes poetry and does political activism. More ecological, political. There is a day when the road neither comes nor goes, and the way is not a way, but a place. There is a day when the road neither comes nor goes, and the way is not a way, but a place. So he's using the word place, and I'm just bringing it in right exactly what I'm saying, talking about the loss of a sense of place. We lose our place inside. We find a different kind of place. A place, a groundless place, a place that is space. So it could be, when we talk about the heart, the experience of unpacking, practicing not being moved from the hurt. So this is another tricky part when we come to the heart to try to find kindness. Most of what happens here is, and what we're used to, is this other version of plugging into negativity is moving from the hurt, reacting from a place of hurt, mostly from the past, mostly not about what's now. And so then we practice again, knowing that I'm really sure about this, but maybe I also know it's not true at all. And then it dawns on us that it's like not true at all. What I was so sure of, not true at all. Not true at all. And it can be dizzying to accept that my whole version of my life, it's not my whole life, but my whole version of my life, my memory of my history of me is delusion. And it doesn't mean that there wasn't other stuff happening. There was still the limitless part going on and coming through. But my version of me, so it's important to notice that it's not you, but your version of you that completely falls apart and let it go. So it can feel like, where's my heart? What, I don't know how to love anymore. it would be good when I'm interested in more kindness in my life, if I get so interested in that and I explore, experiment, make room for it, and I come to the point where I don't know what kindness is and I can't find it and I don't know how to do it. That would be the best way. That's the day when the road neither comes nor goes, and the way is not a way, but a place, but we could say a space. And so we're looking for something. We're hoping to dig down deep enough to find that tender, big, loving, sweet heart. And it isn't there. That was just some candy, mind candy, to get you to go. And to start to get the hang of going. And how is it going? And then going isn't going anymore. The way is not a way, but a place, a space. What happens then is we get to enjoy how through that space comes kindness. And we go, wow. Really, like, we're amazed by the kindness that happens. And it's equally challenging and equally well, the kindness that comes, you're able to receive. That's so hard. To receive kindness. And the kindness that goes through you like a lightning bolt, that you were not planning to be kind to that person. So the unpacking and letting go. We start out trying to find our true nature. We start trying to find enlightenment. We start trying to find our real heart. And we're looking for something. And when we find it, it isn't something, we think that we've gone wrong. And we feel completely lost. And so that's where the steadiness is really important. And today, instead of steadiness, we're use one of my best teachings I ever got is don't freak out. I was going from India back to the United States one of those times. And I went to my teacher and humbly asked for some suggestions and teachings for my trip to the United States. And he said, don't freak out. That's all. And I was like, oh, come on, give me a real. And that must be 20 years ago. It's great. When people say equanimity, they mean don't freak out. When I said steadiness, calmness, don't freak out. That's all. But really, the possibility that we don't need to freak out is what it means. It doesn't mean don't freak out. It means you may not need to freak out, even though all the instruction manuals would tell you, now is when you freak out. You may not need to, like even in the really extreme situation. And we know it doesn't help to freak out. So. There's a day when the road neither comes nor goes. So we're going somewhere. And we're going because we want to get somewhere. And then we find we can't go anymore. And also there's nothing that could go and there's nothing that could be found. And it feels wrong. That sounds, wow, that sounds great. No, it usually feels terrible. There's a terrible story. It's not a nasty story or whatever, but it's, wow. One time, Gautam Buddha got ready in the morning and he went towards the village to collect, to receive food. And his son, Rahula, also did the same. He was also a monk by that time. And in the text, it's interesting, these old texts, because there's all of these unnecessary words that are repeated in all about how they get up and get ready and do their robes and get their bowls. It's like, come on. He got up and he went to get his food. And then there's these minimal little lines that are just slightly different. And that's what you watch out for. That's where all the meaning, that's where the story is. That's where the life of the story is. So in this story, there's all this about he got on his robes and he did this with his robe and okay, he's going to get his food. And then the son is doing the same and followed closely behind his father. Okay, so that something is going to happen there with that closely following. And they're walking towards the village with their bowls. And the father turns around. Well, he doesn't. He looks back. It doesn't even say turns around. He looked back and said to Rahula, any kind of material form whatever, whether past, future, or present, internal or external, gross or subtle, inferior or superior, far or near, can be seen as it is with proper wisdom. This is not mine. This I am not. This is not myself. And Rahula, what we find out, what we kind of realize later, is that Rahula is shocked by this. The father turns around, doesn't turn around, looks back, and says, any material form of any kind can be seen, he says should be seen, but anyway, can be seen with proper wisdom as it is. So that's good news, like things can be seen as they are with proper wisdom. What is that? That it's not mine. What seems to happen is Rahula, in his shock, kind of doesn't know what to say, and so he says, only material form, sir? Only material form? So only this? We've been exploring touch today, or I hope you have enjoyed being in the realm of touch. So what can be touched is material form. And also what has a subtle touch, the energy that we can sometimes feel, the texture of. No matter how great or how horrible, can be seen with proper wisdom as it is. This is not mine. And Rahula says, only material form, blessed one, only material form, sublime one. And then Buddha says, no, kind of like, you know how it goes. It's not only the form, it's also everything else, including consciousness. Not mine. But the point that the Buddha was making was not the form. And then Rahula stops and says, how could someone who'd just been personally admonished by the Blessed One? So he took it as his father giving him a direct critique. How could someone who just got a direct lightning bolt from Gautam Buddha just go about the ordinary day and go into get the food? And so he went and meditated all day. He skipped lunch. And luckily, Shariputta came by. I think Shariputta might have seen what happened and was like, Gautam, that was a little harsh. And went over and said, practice mindfulness of breathing. It's really good. It's really helpful. And so then Rahula spends the whole day meditating under the tree. At the end of the day, goes to his dad and says, would you please tell me how to meditate on the breath? So sweet. He spent all day with this great teacher telling him, meditate on the breath. And he must have tried, and he realizes he doesn't really know what he's doing. And he asks, or maybe it's an excuse to ask his dad something. And that his dad, Gautam Buddha, starts out not by saying anything about the breath. He just says everything about the body. So everything that you could possibly find in the body that's solid, not yours. Everything that you could find in the body that's liquid, not yours. As it in your body, also outside your body. So the father is saying to the son, don't be attached to me, to my form. And gave him quite a lightning bolt. And now he's like, okay, giving him an easier way. Just as you can notice that you didn't make your body, neither the solid nor the liquid nor the air nor the warmth nor the space of your body did you make. And how is it when you experience it as not yours? Just in that same way, every other form that's outside of you. So he doesn't say directly, including my form, your father's form, not yours. Eventually he gets around to the teaching on the breath, which I hope you may have read sometime. And it's not only to, yes, notice if the out-breath is long, it's long, if it's short, it's short, but also gladdening the mind, feeling the breath, bringing rapture into the mind, feeling the breath. So it's not only, it's lightening up and feeling the breath, letting, by being with the breath, the possibility of joy in the mind. But for us, the interesting part is limited and limitless. So there is a material form. There is what we can see and touch. And there are connections and relations, and there can be, it can be in harmony. It can be of great benefit. We can free each other. But the way that we've been educated, and we've also agreed to be with each other, is if I love you, you're mine. If I love you, I own you. And that's going back to the original aggression, and we've lost track of love. Because that we feel we want to hold on to what we love. But somewhere deeply we know we not only cannot hold on to what we love, we somewhere deeply don't want to hold on. We love when that person that we love is feeling they can really be themselves. And then it's acceptable the friction when their priority is different from my priority. But that takes a lot of practice. But what it takes more is like a really deep, direct honesty that goes against the collective norm. It goes against the culture of any culture. So we can feel love, and we can notice when it's a there's something that's it's this. What was that? Outflowing? Outpouring? Outpouring of myself, she said. And we can simply know the difference between outpouring of myself or outpouring of something that feels good to let it go out. And what has come to be called love, or even including kindness, even kindness. So then when we feel love, we can pause or even stop. And remember, not mine. And we might as well start with this not mine, so that also not mine. And it might help to be that base. This not mine, like you're talking to an animal or a baby. This not mine, this not mine, this not mine, this not mine. And what happens then is this wonderful acceptance of the person as they are. As they are. Including what I hate about them. And then I can love them. Then that comes again, the outpouring. It doesn't mean I never say, you know, I really like when you talk quietly to me. And it's really easy for me to freak out when you yell at me. Like, we can still say things. It's not that we just sort of But the way of saying and the way of finding how love loves. So first the practice of pausing or stopping, not mine, not mine. Acceptance comes. We can't make ourselves accept. That's called repression and denial. But we can, not mine, not, like, get the facts straight. This is not mine. I didn't make it. I don't know how it makes itself. I don't know why it makes itself. And obviously, I don't know, and I didn't make that. And when I'm there, wow. Isn't it? It's like something comes off the eyes, and wow, you're beautiful. So then, maybe I can give, example from at the time in the continent, the land where I was born before the European invasion, the people lived there who talked about living with all the creatures. So there were animals that we call wild animals in what we call the wild, where they lived, the people lived. And they said, they weren't wild, those like millions of buffalo that could trample you in a second. And the poisonous snakes, etc., venomous snakes, etc. They said it was no longer the case by the time this person spoke. this one Native American person. So he had to say in the past, it wasn't wild for us. They lived in the middle of it. They were part of that freedom. And there was a harmony and there was a communication. So it wasn't that there weren't venomous snakes anymore. And it wasn't that they had magic that they controlled the venomous snakes with, but they had communication. And they had this is communication, this openness, this not mine, not mine. And what not mine leaves space for is the limited and the limitless. Friendly.